Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Lord of a Shattered Land by Howard Andrew Jones, narrated by Kevin T. Collins. Book 1, freely adapted from the Hanavid of Antiris Sosilos the Elder, with the commentary of Silenus. Andronikos Sosilos the Younger. Preamble. When he was young, the Dervans say, Hanavar swore an oath before his father and the gods. With one hand on an altar red with blood, he pledged to give no rest to Dervans, and to seek their end so long as he drew breath. Hanavar's enemies spread this fable to explain his matchless drive, and, with the hubris of their kind, assumed themselves the center of his universe. Even those who know a greater measure of the truth repeat the lies, so Hanavar emerges as a figure ominous as a thunderhead. Any who knew him tell a different tale, though few of them are left, and none who knew him half so well as I. While many have praised his guile and his skill, another gift too often goes unsung. He set fires in the hearts of those he met. If you marched with him for even a little while, you came to share his dream, and would hazard blood and soul to see it through. You ask what truly drove him on. The answer is a simple one. Love. He loved his daughter. He loved his people. He loved his city. The silver towers of sea-girt Volanus perished with its walls, as did the shining winged serpents who had called the city home since its founding. The Dervan legions wrought this end. They threw down the city's idols, and they melted down her altars, and they carted off her treasures. They sowed her fields with salt. His daughter and his people, they led away in chains. The Dervans dared this only after they had seen Hanavar plummet to the cobalt waves. They jeered the name they once spoke with dread. Some few feared his death was false, that he had worked some strange new scheme. They were mocked. Once he had brought the Dervan Empire to its knees. Now its legions had struck back, and they proudly boasted they had slain him with his city. You who read this know that they were wrong, but cannot guess the fuller tale, for I have never set it down. Long years have passed, and I pray I've time to tell it all, and skill at last to render it in a way that might have pleased him. And so I sing of a man in the shadow of war. He crawled from the wine-dark sea onto an island at the world's edge. Only foes stepped forth to greet him. For any other, that would have been the end. For Hanavar, it was only a beginning. Antires Sosilos, The Hanavid, Book 1. Chapter 1. The Way of Serpents. 1. He had lived in darkness among the unseen things that chittered in the walls. Now a shirtless, barefoot slave preceded him, the orange glare of his lantern dangling from an outthrust hand. Grim guards marched behind, identical in turquoise kilts. The tramp of their feet had such clockwork precision, Hanavar left off numbering his own paces and counted theirs. The procession wound past the cell doors, standing silent and gray, like so many tombstones, and into a hall stacked with wooden barrels and chests. Beyond lay the stairs, which led to blessed sunlight and an unpleasant end. 12 paces stretched between him and that firstmost step, then 10, and then the slave veered away, leading him under a stone archway to the right. Hanavar counted these paces, too. He would know the way, even without a lantern. A turn under an ancient archway brought them to a hall awash with such brilliance, Hanavar narrowed his eyes. 3 days within the cell had left him challenged by the wall's torches. The corridor held a mystery greater than the flood of illumination. 3 men knelt beside a pile of stone bricks and a bucket of mortar. They shaped a low wall across the bottom of an open doorway. On the other side of the growing barrier, a shelf of jeweled goblets twinkled brilliantly next to a small basket of pearls. Did the islanders mean to wall him in with the treasures? That made no sense. The ruler would earn a kingly fee for turning him over to the Durvan Empire. Hanavar had known his fate the moment they'd found him half-drowned on their beach. The slave set his lantern on the floor and genuflected at the stout man in ochre silks who stepped out over the growing wall. "On your knees," one of the guards prodded Hanavar with the butt of his staff. Hanavar knelt. The stone was cold against his legs. "I do not like your look." So saying, Narada's king stopped in front of him. Hanavar had not only an excellent vantage point from which to observe the ruler's sandals, speckled with polished jade and onyx, but to obtain his hostage. They'd obligingly granted him a tarnished spoon, the handle of which he'd sharpened into a point and tucked into his belt. Yet he did not act. This meeting felt less like a prelude to Durvan arrest and more like an interview. He would bide his time. "You may rise," the king said, as though permitting a grand luxury. "Slow," one of the guards cautioned. Hanavar obeyed, his eyes fixed upon the king's. Like Hanavar himself, the king neared his 50th year, but aside from their dark, olive-toned skin, Hanavar found nothing similar in their appearance. The king's balding head was crowned with a diamond-studded headband, and his clean-shaven chin and cheeks were padded with fat. Hanavar stood a full head taller, his shoulders broad, his scarred arms and legs corded with muscle. His dark hair, peppered with gray, was thick and full. He wore a dirty white knee-length tunic, belted at the waist. His gray and brown beard was more than a week overdue for trimming. "I have treated you well, General," the king said. "I hope you will remember that." Hanavar remembered the dark cell with the meager food, the pillowless stone shelf, and the doom he knew they'd summoned. He kept his expression bland. "I will remember all you've done for me." Like many tyrants, the king seemed to lack the capacity to perceive irony, although it might have been that he heard it too rarely for apperception. He nodded once, as though he'd received the praise he was due, then continued. "Circumstances being what they are, I'm willing to offer you an alternative to imprisonment and death at the hands of the Empire." Hanavar said nothing. "Are you not curious?" He awaited details. "Speak on, O King." "They say you know the ways of the great serpents." Whatever the king meant by that, he clearly hoped for an answer in the affirmative, so Hanavar gave him one. "I do." The king motioned Hanavar's guards back. Only a few moments ago, Hanavar would have sprung forward to press his sharpened handle to the king's throat. Now he grasped another option. It would be far better to walk free after striking a bargain than to flee with a hostage. The king explained. This morning, a Kakanan bird brought a message from the Outer Isles. The Southerners have swept forth in a great raid. Their ships fill the ocean. They have burned and looted throughout the Lenadines, and they are on their way toward Narata. That explained only a little. Did the king truly hope to hide his wealth from the merciless Southerners behind a false dungeon wall? "Have you nothing to say?" the king snapped. "Do you have a question?" The king scowled. "Can you or can you not summon serpents?" No man alive knew how to call the great winged Asalda. Those who'd never worked with them misunderstood the nature of their relationships with humans. "I know their ways," Hanavar said. "And can you master them?" Now he lied outright. "Yes," the king nodded. "In the center of my island lives a great winged serpent. My grandfather's father made a pact with the creature, so it would protect our island if we kept her from harm. I'm sending a priestess to remind the beast of her duty, and I am sending you to command her should she break her oath." "And I'm to go free afterward?" "Of course." A lie, clearly, but Hanavar bowed his head as though he believed. "I'll require the flask I carried. My wizard tells me it's full only of ashes. Is it some magic unknown to him?" "How do you think I control the serpents?"
"Ah, I see."
"I'll want a sword," Hanavar continued.
"When your task is through."
And a ship. The king would never grant him that, but it was crucial the monarch think Hanavar believed him.
"Certainly," the king pledged breezily. "Now you must hurry. The messenger bird arrived hours ago. My priestess tells me that means the Southerners will arrive near dawn. These two will lead you where you need to go."
"I need food." The lunch hour had come and gone without a meal, and a bath and shave.
"Fine. Eat quickly."
The king half turned, waving a hand, then halted in mid-motion.
"Hold," he considered Hanavar once more. "You know siege craft, don't you?"
"Somewhat." The irony of asking this of the general who'd brought the Dervan Empire to its knees escaped the king.
"This stonework, will it hold, given time to dry?"
"Yes, but if you want to fool the Southerners, you have to do a better job disguising your entryway." The king's jowls trembled in agitation.
"What do you mean?"
Hanavar advanced to the doorway, seeing a couch, wine jars, and a food-laden table set before gold statues and a basket of sapphires and rubies. "The Southerners are old hands at sniffing out treasure. They'll see the outline of where a doorway used to be. If you want to conceal yourself, you need to rip out the doorway's frame to blend the stone with the existing wall." The king blinked at him and turned his head to consider the masonry. Two of the workmen looked up while the other troweled mortar.
"Idiots!" the king said finally. "Why didn't you point that out? Rip this down and start over! Immediately!"
They blinked in surprise, then hurriedly began to remove the stones they'd just laid. Hanavar expected they'd be killed the moment they finished their work, so none could reveal the king's hiding place. He couldn't help wondering what measures the king had taken to ensure a way out, should his loyal retainers be slain, or neglect to open the vault for a few weeks. But that was the king's concern. 2. The cliff's edge loomed just past his outstretched fingers. Hanavar shifted his left foot, then froze as a trail of dirt crumbled beneath his sandal. It spilled onto the upturned face of one of the twin guards. Meshtar, he thought, then rattled down the rock face to the distant jungle. Meshtar shook his head like an angry dog. Hanavar secured his footing, and with a little more leverage, gripped the edge of a sturdy rock and hauled himself up, dislodging an even larger stream of dirt onto the twin. In another moment he had gained the plateau. Bright blue flowers blossomed on green stalks, waving in the warm air. Hanavar lay on his stomach in the tough grasses and offered his hands to Meshtar. The guard grunted his thanks as he reached the top, then flopped down beside him to assist the others. Hanavar climbed to his feet, wiping sweat from his newly shorn cheeks, and watched. Next up was dark-haired Rudra, general of Narata, though general was a grand term for the commander of an island force numbering less than 100 warriors. Rudra styled his hair elaborately, so it rose in a black wave. Hanging from his belt, opposite the garish sword sheath, was Hanavar's flask, the size of a small water jug. The general had insisted on carrying it himself until they reached the serpent, saying he didn't trust Hanavar not to work sorceries against them. Following him was the young sea priestess, Lalasa. The azure pendant of her office hung to her azure bodice. Her matching flowered skirt swirled about her calves as they raised her. She stepped away to brush dirt from her hands. Finally came Meshtar's brother, Beshkar, his small eyes set and determined. Hanavar had already decided the general was a soldier only in title. Strong, able, silent, these two were the real threat. Hanavar unstopped his wineskin and drank. They had advanced past huddled refugees into the jungle's depths hours before. The island's only large settlement was a 2-hour hike behind them, lost beyond the waving greenery. "How much farther?" Rudra asked. Lalasa answered, her voice high and clear. "We look for a bridge now, to Mount Danar." The sea priestess shook out her hair, gathered it together, and tied it more tightly behind her head. She ignored the frank appraisal from the twins. That a woman in her middle 20s was the lead priestess in the island nation had surprised Hanavar, but he had not yet asked for an explanation, and no one had offered one. "Let's keep moving," Rudra ordered. Lalasa pointed left. This time Rudra led. There were no man-made trails, but they came to an animal track and walked it, veering left. Hanavar pushed past a brown vine big as his arm and stepped over a fallen tree bole thick with yellow ants. A rich, floral scent perfumed the air. They reached a clearing. A single goat cropped at the thick green grass that lay between the jungle and the cliff edge 30 paces on. A dilapidated wooden suspension bridge stretched from it to another cliffside. Rudra stepped into the clearing without hesitation. Something crashed violently through the bushes on their right, alarming the goat, which fled into the brush. A leathery, skeletal thing erupted from the jungle, leapt in front of the bridge, and opened its beak with a hiss. Rudra froze, but the twins drew steel. Lalasa touched her pendant. The creature was half again the height of a man. Leathery skin flaps stretched between its long, bony arms and its waist. It shook its blue-feathered head and clacked its beak.
"If you would pass, you would pay," it rasped.
"What would you have us pay?" Hanavar asked. It tilted its head and stabbed the sea priestess with sharp eyes.
"Give me the soft one."
"We have fine wine with us," Lalasa countered. The thing cocked its head, swift and bird-like. "Yes," she said, "fine and sweet."
"Give me the drink."
Lalasa looked to Rudra, who stared back blankly until she pointed at his wineskin and motioned toward the monster. Rudra fumbled to untie the skin from his belt. He threw it at the creature's clawed feet. It bent, snatched up the skin, and fumbled with the stopper before losing patience and biting it off. It upended the container into its beak and guzzled greedily. Dark red wine trickled down either side of its face. Meshtar swore in disgust.
"More!"
The thing shook the empty skin at them. "We will give you more after we pass," Hanavar said. The bird thing's gaze shifted between them.
"You will each give me the sweet."
"We'll give you one more," the sea priestess promised. "We'll leave it for you on the bridge's far side."
"All!"
It flapped its wings rapidly. "One," the priestess said, "or we will go back into the jungle." The bird thing hopped once, then scurried to one side.
"I will watch. If you trick me, I eat you."
"Try, and we'll kill you," Rudra growled. Hanavar led the way onto the bridge. The bird thing obviously hadn't spent its spare time in maintenance of its ambush point. Some of the ancient planks pointed skyward, as though heavy weights had been dropped on their far ends. Hanavar and the others stepped carefully over the gaps, through which they glimpsed a gurgling jungle stream 100 feet down. They soon stood on the other side. Lalasa lifted her wineskin high so the monster would see it, then bent to place it on the bridge. The creature was already scampering to retrieve it as Lalasa guided them into the jungle. Hanavar listened for sounds of pursuit, but heard nothing. When the sun lowered over the palms, circling a little clearing, Lalasa called a halt.
"We'll rest until the moon is high."
"We should keep moving," Rudra said.
"And how will we see, with the dark jungle on every side?" Lalasa asked. "Now's the time to rest and eat. We'll move when moonlight marks the way."
Rudra grumbled to the twins, who gathered wood for a small cook fire while he hunkered down on a nearby boulder and slapped at insects. Hanavar stepped to the clearing's edge and bent down to touch his toes. More and more each year he felt the aches and pains of age. "You care for every weapon after use," his father had told him when he was young. "So, too, should you care for your body." And so Hanavar had learned to ease strain from his muscles and joints, moving carefully through martial forms with his father each morning and night. He had turned his attention to his calf muscles when Lalasa joined him. There in the shadow of the trees, she was little more than a silhouette, exuding the mixed scent of fragrant soaps and healthy sweat. She brushed off a nearby log, sat down, and watched him. For a time there was no sound other than the calls of night animals, one of which let out a repetitious, shrieking whoop.
"You are really a master of serpents?" the priestess asked.
"I know their ways." Hanavar climbed to his feet, widened his stance, and slowly rotated his arms.
"You speak the truth," she said. "There's sadness in your mind when you think of the golden serpent in the water."
Hanavar paused, staring at her dark form, and strove to blank his mind. He'd underestimated her. "You're a mind reader."
"Not one of any great skill, but I sense the feelings of others and sometimes glimpse portions of their thoughts. It's like pressing up against a thin curtain. I can see what lies on the other side, if the light is right."
"And what do you read from those three?" Hanavar asked quietly. His head turned toward the twins, one of whom was adjusting the fire tinder while the other dug through his supply pack. Rudra drank from Hanavar's wineskin, which he'd appropriated shortly after they left the creature.
"From the general?"
"Little," she whispered. "Nervousness, irritation. The other pair, there's darkness there, and I don't want to venture close."
"They're soldiers.
They're killers."
"So am I," Hanavar said. The priestess grew silent. Hanavar bent his head toward his knee.
She shook her head.
"It's not the same. There was a boatman in the village where I received my training, renowned far and wide for his skill. Men said he had been blessed by the gods, so wondrous was his talent. His mind felt something like yours."
He laughed lightly. "I'm not blessed."
She spoke swiftly, with great feeling.
"I'm sorry they imprisoned you. They had no right. The Dervins are no allies of Narada. You should have been sent on your way."
She was young, but surely she knew the appeal of gold. He wasn't surprised so much that they'd imprisoned him, but that anyone so far from the mainland had recognized him from his belt crest and signet ring. Hanavar sat beside her, his mind returning to those impossibly long weeks on the deserted islet building rafts. Neither had been truly seaworthy. The second had delivered him within sight of Narada's coast before sinking. It had been a long swim, and not his first. The priestess had called him blessed, but a blessed man could have convinced more of his people to heed his calls to arms. A blessed man would not have lost his army, his people, his family, his city, his friend, Eladiva, the Golden Serpent. After the Dervin catapult stone had struck her from the sky, Eladiva had been too injured to fly, but she had carried him through rough waves for most of a day, and then she too had perished, and his only hope had been that tiny islet upon the horizon. The priestess interrupted his musing.
"Was Volanus truly as lovely as they say?"
Her voice was kind. Had she glimpsed the last view of his city etched in his mind, as tendrils of smoke stretched skyward above the burning temples and the red-tiled houses? Could she hear the screams of his people?
"It was like any city," Hanavar answered flatly. "There were criminals and priests, beggars and rich men, performers and warriors and bakers and cobblers. More often than not, those who ruled had more money than wisdom."
"You're lying," she said after a moment.
He met her eyes. Here, at close range, their whites glimmered with a red pinpoint from the cook fire.
"Her beauty was peerless," he admitted,
"but her silver towers lie shattered by the sea, and the blood of her people has run into the water. Derva crouches like a fat toad amongst the ashes." Lalasa said nothing, but he felt her recoil. Doubtless now she sensed the truth.
"I too am a killer, priestess," he said. "I can recite poetry and the works of Edera, frame witty quips, trade pleasantries with ladies of the court. But the Dervins fear me with reason."
"You will help us, won't you?"
Hanavar studied her. "Why do you aid a tyrant?"
"I seek the Asalda to help the king help his people."
She paused.
"At the very least, the southerners will burn the city. But you know as well as I that they make a sport of hunting islanders. Sometimes they leave the women after they rape them, but sometimes they take them, or kill them."
"So do the strong among the weak."
"Is that what you did, among the weak?"
"I sought to crush the empire before it destroyed us."
"You're a man of oaths and principles," she stated, almost as if to remind him of the fact.
"Your king will turn me over to the Dervins when we return."
"Help me complete my task," Lalasa said with quiet urgently, "and I'll aid you." She broke off as Rudra drew close. The small fire backlit the general.
"What are you two whispering about?"
Sample complete. Ready to continue?